listening to Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn, welcoming you to the Trading Post this evening. If you'd like to join us out in the chat room, you can come down to bb9tradingpost.chitango.com. That's bb9tradingpost.chitango.com. Got quite the crew in there still. Mr. Graham Hart has joined us. Welcome, good sir. Mr. Nick Downing, SPQR 2017 has made it. Welcome back. Anybody else showing up new? If you're there and I'm not seeing you, Miss Snippets has joined us. Welcome, Miss Snippets. Great cartoons on Saturday, as always. Thank you. Tonight is episode 86 and is entitled Everybody Was Kung Fu Shaming. Now, when I was a young lad, there was a TV series in the United States called Kung Fu, starring David Carradine. And it quickly became one of the most watched series, both in my household and in the United States. It was, we loved that show. And it's really interesting now to go back and look at that show and see all the rules for radical screenwriters, cultural Marxist shaming of white people that was in every episode. And that was, part of the programming was you put the outsider into these Western communities. These, basically, they always showed these small Christian communities where this wandering stranger would come in, and it was always white people behaving badly, and this half Chinese, half European traveler, the wanderer, his name was Hua Cheng Kang, played by David Carradine, always had the moral high ground because he was a Shaolin Buddhist priest. And so that had so much going on that was so relative to the times of the 1970s, where everything was being challenged and new philosophies were being brought into the household and the communities. So instead of having a homogeneous system, this family is Baptist, this family is Catholic, we have our doctrines and the whole community shares these beliefs pretty much, to this, suddenly you've got a multicultural world at play where, Christianity has a full spectrum of beliefs, and then how different is Christianity from Buddhism, and what is Hinduism, and all these other things, especially people going off to college under these liberal arts professors that are mostly Jewish, taking their liberal arts studies, to be told everything their family values was wrong, all their heroes were actually bad people, the founding fathers, any person of note in European history, they made sure to tell you all the dirt on that person as part of the cultural Marxist programming to keep tearing, keep pounding on dead white guys, as the Harvard professor would say, to disillusion the students, demoralize them, and make them self-hate. And so they'd come home on the weekends and fight with their parents, fight with their siblings, fight with their ministers at church or their priests at church, etc. And reject these systems that they've been poisoned against. And I think, my family was ground zero for all of this. And, I remember, this was at a time when we were still at war with Vietnam, and one of the things about warfare is you always adopt the symbols and icons of your enemy. And so we had Fort Bragg here, or we have Fort Bragg here in North Carolina, which was one of the main staging areas for Vietnam, And it still has the name of Vietnam because you just had so many people that moved from Vietnam into the Fayetteville area and set up Little Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And so suddenly you were immersed in Vietnamese and Asia Pacific culture in the 60s and 70s because of the war in Vietnam. And I think a lot of that, you know, you started seeing it when we were at war during World War II with Germany and Japan and Italy, of course. But, you know, so you get that part of Asia Pacific coming in, you know, the Japanese, how many people moved from Japan to the United States after the war? How many GIs took Japanese wives after World War II, just like how many GIs took Vietnamese wives during the Vietnamese War. Okay, so you get all of that coming in. So the two components of the Kung Fu series were both the Eastern forms of martial arts that were very still novel at the time. It was something very new. And like we talk about on the show a lot, you know, one of the, I guess, weaknesses that was exploited of the Americans was our love of novelty. Americans love new things, and I think the Jews really exploited that. And so anything new became very fashionable and became the craze. And so growing up, suddenly, not only did you have a Japanese restaurant in every town, a Chinese restaurant in every town, a Vietnamese restaurant in every town, a Korean restaurant in every town, but, oh, and also, you know, you think of the Korean War, you had the Koreans coming over, you know, before Vietnam, but, you know, so you get the restaurants, but, you know, you also got the various martial arts studios in every town. So suddenly every town had a karate studio. Suddenly every town had a taekwondo studio for the Korean martial arts. Karate is Japanese. Then kung fu. One of the oldest kung fu academies is here in Boone. Grandmaster Cash has been doing his academy forever up here. And you know, most of the kung fu studios that exist in North Carolina were started by people who studied under Grandmaster Cash. I studied under one of his students in Raleigh when I was studying kung fu in Raleigh in the 90s. I studied taekwondo in the 80s and kung fu in the 90s. And, you know, so it was very interesting to be immersed in those cultures and those structures of the martial arts. But also, you know, you suddenly had this interest of the counterculture in Eastern philosophies, especially Buddhism, Zen, and things like the I Ching. And again, going to college, and that's where people would learn all these things and bring them back. And so, you know, I guess in my generation, everybody was reading Alan Watts or Hermann Hesse, especially Siddhartha. You know, I think pretty much everybody I went to school with had a dog-eared version of Siddhartha, the story of the Buddha by Hermann Hesse, or had at least one Alan Watts book on Zen or Taoism or, you know, any of the other Eastern philosophies. Now, when we look at the history, one of the earliest, or I should say oldest, players is the I Ching itself. If you've never studied the I Ching, it's a fascinating system, especially people who understand binary math, because that's basically what you're doing with the I Ching, is building these hexagrams based on whether something is the one or zero, the heads or the tails of the coin. If you're using a coins to do an I Ching toss, if you're using Yarrow stocks, it's about getting numbers between 6 and 9 to build your, they called it the wall. You start at the bottom, your foundation, and you build up 6 layers based on these so-called chance tosses, chance rolls, you know, coin toss or whatever, to build up one of 64 possible combinations. And so when you start studying computer science, you know, that's one of those magic numbers of, you know, 64. You know, how do you get from binary? How many places do you need to get 64? And so you think, you know, what was the intelligence level, the IQ level of a culture that would develop something like the I Ching around 1000 BC? You know, so that was a pretty sophisticated system, and it's basically, and to me, an example of how we moved. And I'm painting with a very broad brush here, so please excuse me. But if you look at the religions and philosophies that developed after the last great ice age, one of the patterns you see, especially in European and Asian cultures, is things moving from chance. And a lot of those systems developed in the T4 silver era, about 16,000 to 10,000 BC, where everything's chance. You know, the idea of casting lots, rolling dice, casting lots, those kinds of things were chance. And then in T3 copper era, you start getting this idea of fate, that something is written, your fate is sealed. And so those systems developed around 10,000 to 4,000 BC. And then the Iron Era, you start seeing, you know, the idea of free will from about 4,000 BC to about 2000 AD, you know, and just, you know, those systems. So with the I Ching, it's interesting that whereas, you know, the foundations of the idea of chance and tossing lots goes back, you know, 10,000 BC when we start seeing dice, but to be put into this system of the Book of Changes around 1000 is, you know, very unique to me. And I think Carl Jung, in his work on synchronicity, was also fascinated with the I Ching, because part of the system of the I Ching is it's more than the random chance of the coin tosses, that you get this synchronicity effect with the I Ching that isn't just total random chance. And so that's part of the philosophy. Also, the idea of the symbols in the hexagram images, basically significant symbols will pop out at you. And that's also part of the philosophy. But in context, when the I Ching was developed, you know, 700 to 500 BC is when we first start seeing the Great Wall of China being begun. Now, other things going on in the world, around 586, remember, that's when the temple was burned in Jerusalem, beginning the Babylonian captivity. And 582, Pythagoras is born in Samos, Greece. In 566 BC, Prince Siddhartha is born in India. And, of course, you know, Prince Siddhartha would go on to become the Buddha in the founding of Buddhism. And so you think, you know, right at the same time the temple's being destroyed, Babylonian captivity in Jewish mythology, and Pythagoras is being born, you're in India, you're seeing the beginnings of Buddhism. Now, Buddhism took a long time to spread throughout the world, and it's interesting to see where Buddhism spread, but then when Islam came into power, a lot of the Buddhist nations were converted into Islam, which is interesting to see how that could happen, that a culture that once embraced Buddhism would embrace Islam. But you know, that's another story for another time. But in 549, Cyrus II, the Great, leads the Persian Empire to war against the Medes. 539 BC, Babylon falls to the Persians. In 534 BC, Thespis is the first poet from Icara to win the prize for tragedy at the Dionysus Festival in Athens. So, you know, the Greeks are having, you know, these poetry contests over here. You've got Pythagoras. The Jews are over here with the captivity. You've got the beginnings of Buddhism over here in India. And in China, they're developing systems like the I Ching. Later, you know, things like Taoism that would ride on top of the I Ching. That was kind of the, in 500 BC, Lao Tzu founds Chinese Taoism. And, oh, also in Persia in 500 BC, Zarathustra forms the Pari religion in Persia. And then in 400 BC, Patanjali writes his basic yoga in 196 statements. And so the basic foundations of what we know as yoga, that all started in 400 BC. Then 399, Socrates is executed in Athens. 387, Plato founded the Academy in Athens. 335, Aristotle founded the Lyceum in Athens. And then in 322, like we talked about, Persian rule of Jerusalem overthrown by Alexander the Great, and the Jews are allowed to return to Jerusalem. So, you know, that's just kind of, you know, what was going on in the world when these Eastern philosophies were being developed in Asia. And so it's just fascinating to me that these different cultures develop these different systems, and sometimes they were very similar, and sometimes they were just completely different than each other. Now, in the I Ching, I found it interesting that the hexagram 61 is the Kung Fu. Reaching for my copy of the I Ching here and making the squeaky chair squeak. But I'd never make it on professional radio. But anyway, so hexagram 61 is inner truth. And that was part of the double entendre of tonight's show title. You know, everybody was kung fu shaming. And this is what I see so much about identity politics of this civil war being fomented between us and them, where you've got this identity politics of my inner truth is this and my inner truth is this, but yours is wrong and mine is right. And so these people sitting there and, you know, it's hard to see our so-called best and brightest being led by these professional agent provocateurs to not only hurl insults at each other, but to hurl projectiles, and we're actually seeing cases of the Antifa throwing fecal matter and urine bombs and all these other things at, you know, these people that identify differently than the Antifa. And it's just like, you know, groups of monkeys flinging dung at one another. And, you know, here it's, you know, their kung fu, your inner truth fighting and shaming and trying to break each other's will by attacking their inner truth. And the symbol of this particular hexagram is the sun above, which is the gentle and the wind, and then below is Tui, which is the joyous lake. And, you know, so those two symbols together form the Kung Fu, the inner truth hexagram. Now, in 464 AD, Batuyu, who was a Dhyana master, came to China from India to spread the Buddhist teachings. So that's, you know, much, much later. And one of the things I found over the years researching Shaolin history and the history of the martial arts, there's some really great stories out there and some great legends, but it's the historical record doesn't really support a lot of it. But a lot of people, you know, these groups that, you know, claim their lineages all the way back to this dynasty, that dynasty, it's, you know, very good backstory. But when you actually start to do the forensic archaeological analysis on it, it doesn't hold water. So that was, I guess, fascinating to me today, is finding out a lot of things that I had heard in my respective martial arts classes, which aren't really true. So, but the question becomes, how did this system of Buddhism in India first make its way to China, and then how did it incorporate itself with martial arts in the Shaolin tradition? And so there, like I said, there were lots of theories I found. But one of the, I guess, the best hard facts I saw was in 477 AD, the first Shaolin monastery was built on the north face of Shaoxi, which was the central peak of seven peaks of the Song mountain ranges. And this was by Emperor Zhaoyuan of the Northern Wei Dynasty. And when you study the philosophies of Buddhism, and they also are very much centered around that number seven in a different way than the Jews are centered around the seven. If you've ever heard the Buddhist prayer, the Om Mani Padme Hum, you're looking at a philosophy that has incorporated as one of its axioms reincarnation. And so basically you have seven layers of existence, of the, you know, so-called lower layers that you're born into. And what the prayer does is try to break the cycle, the reincarnation cycle, on each one of those lower layers. And so each part, each syllable of that Om Mani Padme Hum prayer is designed to affect one of those seven layers of their reincarnation model. Now, we could do a complete show on that, but that's basically, you know, again, the broad brush explanation of, you know, what that is. But you can see why they would want to put the monastery in something around that to do with the sevens. And that's very, you know, like I said, very Buddhist in that. Now, some people maintain that it was military men who were trained in martial arts who left to seek the solitude of Buddhism, you know, for whatever reason, to leave warring behind and seek a, you know, this redemption religion, whatever, that introduced martial arts to the Shaolin tradition. And when the Shaolin, one of the times when the Shaolin Temple was destroyed, that the martial arts were distributed by what they called the five rogue monks that took martial arts throughout China after the temple had been destroyed. So again, that's one of the stories. But so that's basically the background of you know, the Shaolin, you know, where that came from out of the monastery system and how it incorporated with martial arts. It's interesting when you look at Kung Fu. I studied what was called Five Animals Kung Fu. And so you had, you know, basically the offenses and defenses based on how to attack different type of opponents that maybe have the same or different energy styles than you do. And so so, for example, you know, you have the crane, the tiger, the monkey, the snake, and the mantis in some systems. The way I learned it, though, was the tiger, crane, leopard, snake, and dragon. And so, you know, the tiger is that very powerful person. You know, the crane is the patient creature that knows when to wait for the opportunity. The leopard is the camouflaged attack, that, you know, the pounce attack, if you will, the sudden attack. The snake, you think a snake is, you know, serpentine, almost hypnotic. You're luring your opponent into your coils, if you will. And then the dragon. The dragon is one of the most interesting to me because, you know, it's the mythical beast. So you're fighting almost like a hydra from Greek mythology, Hercules and the Hydra, where you're fighting the, you know, the adversary you can't really see, and is, you know, more of a phantasm than something real. And so, you know, that was the basis of, you know, looking at these animals. And in European culture, you know, we have in the shamanic cultures, you have the spirit guide animals, the totems. You know, we talk a lot about bears and wolves and crows on this show because, you know, those are a lot of the European totems that we use. And each one of those, you know, creatures has their way of doing things, you know, and it's the way of. And so you'll see that a lot in these Taoist type philosophies, you know, the way of the leopard, the way of the tiger, the way of the dragon. This is how they behave, much like the Europeans. You know, we followed the herds around, the way of the deer, the way of the wolf that's also following the deer while we're following the deer, the way of the bear who happens to be in the cave that we might want to winter over in. You know, so those kind of things. And, you know, the way of the honeybee. So much of European culture is modeled after a honeybee hive, especially when you look at Freemason history and things like that. So, you know, that was the foundation. Now, out of that culture, you had in 1940 a man by the name of Bruce Lee be born. And he was born in Chinatown in the United States in San Francisco. And he became one of the icons of martial arts, and he even developed his own style, but he was often associated with the Kung Fu styles. He used a lot of Kung Fu in his system. And he died tragically and mysteriously in 1973. And what's interesting is his son was born in 1965, Brandon Lee, also died under very curious circumstances in 1993 here in Wilmington, North Carolina, when he was on set down there at the film studios in Wilmington filming his movie The Crow, and basically there was a stage gun that had live ammo in it, and he died of a gunshot wound. So there's a lot of suspicion about both, you know, Bruce Lee and Brandon Lee. Now, David Carradine was born in 1936 and died in 2009. And what's interesting there is David Carradine was an actor who apparently was really living a very degenerate lifestyle while at the same time living this role or behind the mask of this great kung fu icon, both as the actor who played in the kung fu series, but later he actually started studying martial arts and came out, of course, with his own videos, tape series, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when you see the way he died and the circumstances, he wasn't exactly on the monastic path, to say the least. Now, how did these two people become such an icon of this craze of martial arts in the 1970s that continues to this day? Now, we of course know that the U.S. passed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, federally mandating the end of any type of segregation or discrimination based on race. Okay, so basically, everybody was put supposedly at a level playing field. Then in 1965, we had the modified immigration law, which undid the 1920s immigration law, which was designed to limit U.S. immigration mainly to white European Christians. They did not want the anarchist radical Jews coming out of East Asia, and they did not want Asia-Pacific immigration. They wanted to keep the United States basically, you know, white European majority. Well, that all changed in 1965, and so one of the things that we saw immediately was a huge influx of Asia-Pacific immigration, especially from, like we said, you know, Korea and Vietnam, but also, you know, you got a lot of Chinese, you got a lot of Japanese, a lot of Filipino, and so that influx brought that culture with it, and so Hollywood adapted to not only recognize this, but to promote this. Because, you know, you think Jewish Hollywood from day one has been promoting the end of Western civilization, Jewish supremacy, and this idea of multiculturalism and race mixing. And they have just gotten more and more brazen with it as we've gone through the years. But a lot of people think the first official martial arts fight scene in a major Hollywood movie was in 1962 with Frank Sinatra in The Manchurian Candidate. And I put that fight scene in the playlist. Now, I'm sure somebody can say, no, this movie came first, but as far as a major release to a major U.S. audience, and this was one thing that Frank Sinatra always maintained, that, you know, they were the first to have a martial arts fight in any main movie. And so that was 1962. And, of course, we say in 64, the U.S. Civil Rights Act passed. 1965, the Immigration Act passed. 1971, Bruce Lee releases a B film called The Big Boss. And this began what would become an entire genre of Hollywood films, of, you know, the, they call them chop sake films or karate films or whatever, but just, you know, the martial arts fight films. And so one of the first films that was all about martial arts was probably 1971, Bruce Lee, The Big Boss. In 1972, Kung Fu debuted on ABC television in primetime. Now, this, again, it worked at so many levels because the backstory of the pilot movie, and this was the pilot movie, the, you know, made-for-TV movie, the storyline basically went that you had a young boy growing up in China. His real father was an American who came to China, supposedly married a Chinese woman, had the son, Kwa Cheng Kane. Both parents died. He was raised by his maternal grandfather. When he died, he was left orphaned. He went to the Shaolin Temple to apply to for membership to get in, as was the local custom. He was repeatedly refused because of being non-Chinese. He was not 100% Chinese. They could tell he was, you know, a mixed breed. Now, this is key because throughout the series, they always play off how he was not of the Chinese culture, but was embraced by the Shaolin Temple culture. The reality is very different, that, you know, in China, in Korea, in Japan, you know, mixed race children have a horrible life. Many are killed at birth. Once they show that they've got blue eyes or blonde hair, they were killed. And so, you know, these cultures have very, very strict enforcement procedures, if you will, and that's just part of the culture. So to me, that was, you know, a stretch, but they played that, he was finally accepted in, and, you know, his mixed race was acknowledged and questioned. But then, of course, the Grandmaster says, well, there's a first time for everything. And he's accepted in, and then, of course, excels and rises through the ranks to become a Shaolin priest. He's then sent out to roam about, as was the tradition, and he meets up with one of his masters, who was the blind monk, who named him Grasshopper, if you remember the series, whose ambition in life was to go to a certain moon festival on a certain date. So Kwa Cheng Kang goes and meets him, and while they're greeting each other, the emperor's nephew's caravan comes riding through, and one of the guards pushes the blind monk out of the way, and then when he's pushed a second time, the monk retaliates against the royal guard for disrespecting an elder, basically. The prince thinks that, you know, the royal nephew thinks that he's under attack and shoots the monk with this new, you know, Western pistol, which, of course, the monk didn't, you know, he's this martial arts master. You could throw spears at him all day long, shoot arrows at him all day long. Even though he's blind, he could defend himself, but he never saw the bullet coming. And in a fit of rage, you know, the Kwa Cheng Kang takes one of the guard's spears and kills the emperor's nephew. He's then told to flee to America because there will be a bounty on his head. So this is an interesting position to be in, because here the hero of the story has just committed a murder. And it is sold, though, as a justifiable eye for an eye type of system. But, you know, I just think it's interesting that the hero of the story killed one of the royal family, and that this is a storyline being written by Jewish guys in Hollywood. And we see that part of the global communist cultural Marxist agenda was to destroy all the great families in China. And when you look at the so-called Cultural Revolution, what happened when the communists went in under Jewish finance and Jewish consulting, that was so much of what happened was the old family systems were destroyed, and including the emperor. And so this idea of somehow it's okay and justified that you killed the emperor's nephew and then fled justice, and now you're the hero of the show. So yeah, that's something that's going on there in the sub-processes, but you know, this is the hero of the story. And so he flees to America and is trying to find his only relative, which he knows from listening to the family tales that before his American father came to China, he had an American wife and had a son by that wife. And so somewhere he has a half-brother. And so he's on this quest to find his half-brother, who is full European. And so it's like, will he be accepted by that brother and that family when he gets there? So that is basically, the storyline of him, coming to America and then seeing the plight of the Chinese at the hands of the evil white people as they're building the new railroad with all this Chinese labor, and they're exploited, et cetera, et cetera. And it's always, the white Christians. They never talk about any Jews in any of these episodes. And so we see that dynamic being played out, but also the Chinese government has sent out bounty hunters looking for this Shaolin priest, and another Shaolin priest shows up to claim the bounty, and they have the big epic fight at the end. And of course, Kwa Chen Kang kills this guy and pronounces basically that, he will do the same to anybody else who comes after him, And that was the pilot episode, and that ended up going on till 1975. And every episode is basically him being able to go into an area and survive all these white people acting badly. And then you see that being explained by very selective Buddhist and Zen and Tao philosophies that are thrown in as a flashback episode or a flashback sequence. So, yeah, that was 1972. And that same year, Bruce Lee released the second film, Fists of Fury, and that one actually got a lot of box office attention. Also in 72, Way of the Dragon was released. 1973, Enter the Dragon was released. And then that's when he died mysteriously. And they basically had to do the same thing with his last film, The Game of Death, as they had to do with Brandon Lee's film, The Crow, is finish it in post-production, basically. But it wasn't until 1978 that The Game of Death came out, which was Bruce Lee's final film. In 1974... Kung Fu Fighting was released by a man, black man by the name of Carl Douglas, and It was supposed to be a novelty B-side of a single. They did it in the last few minutes of the recording session. But when the record execs heard the A-side and the B-side, they decided to switch them, and they made Kung Fu Fighting the A-side, and that went on to sell over 11 million copies worldwide. So that song was everywhere, and all the discos played it in the 70s. And so that was just one of those fluke hitting the world nerve on martial arts. Now, Bruce Lee got his start in films at a very early age, but as far as a character doing martial arts, probably the first thing you saw him in was as Kato in the Green Hornet series, and that was 1966, and you actually had a couple of overlap episodes with Batman and Robin being visited by the Green Hornet and Kato when they came into Gotham City. So those were some interesting crossover episodes, but he did one season of that. Now, like I said, you know, in 73, Bruce Lee died, but at that point, martial arts were everywhere in the United States. ABC, to cash in, released in 1974 a Hanna-Barbera cartoon called Hong Kong Phooey on Saturday morning cartoons, and was the voiceover was Scatman Crothers, which was a very well-known black voiceover artist and scat singer. It did not go over well and basically lasted until spring, I think, before it was canceled. Now, in 1974, also, the James Bond franchise with Roger Moore released The Man with the Golden Gun, and it had the big martial arts fight scenes with the, you know, martial arts schools being run by the evil international criminals, etc. And James Bond, of course, goes in and defeats all of these martial arts actors or martial arts masters in, you know, the series. They did a reboot in 1993 of Kung Fu with David Carradine called Kung Fu, The Legend Continues. And this was done in Canada. They basically move it to the modern times, and David Carradine plays the grandson of Kwa Chang Kang. Basically has a son. They were at the Shaolin Temple together studying when the Shaolin Temple was destroyed, and they both thought the other was dead. They were later reunited. The son is a policeman, and David Carradine plays the father, who's a martial arts master, monk kind of spiritualist, whatever, and they solve crimes together. Getting back to the cartoons, in 1984, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles first appeared in an American comic book. And again, that was Kevin Eastman, Peter Lard came up with that. That became a huge franchise of toys, games, video games, Saturday morning cartoons, movies. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were huge. 1986, Kung Fu the Movie came out, and that starred David Carradine and Brandon Lee. Now, the interesting thing there with that pairing is the Lee family always maintained that Bruce Lee was the one who had the original pilot idea for the Kung Fu series and kept pitching it to Warner Brothers, and they kept refusing it. And then it looks like, in typical Jewish fashion, they basically took the idea and ran with it somewhere else. But the Lee family always maintained that Bruce Lee came up with the idea of the Kung Fu series and Hollywood stole it from him. In 1987, again, you know, CBS airs Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. 87 also Kung Fu Next Generation with just Brandon Lee in it. Then another big push for, I guess, martial arts in America was in 1993. Fox Kids debuted the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. And the Power Rangers franchise would go on to be one of the biggest Japanese import franchises in the U.S. From playing cards to board games, video games, numerous TV shows, movies, etc. Power Rangers were huge. And then in 2008, the DreamWorks people, and of course that's Spielberg's team, came out with Kung Fu Panda. Again, that was 2008, where, again, incorporating this selective Eastern philosophy with the martial arts and marketing it to children. Now, one of the aspects of this that I've heard repeatedly from elementary school and preschool teachers is that they completely hate Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. They hate Power Rangers. They hate Kung Fu Panda. They hate anything that these very small, impressionable, you know, 5, 6, 7-year-old children are going to watch and do monkey see, monkey do. No amount of discipline, timeouts, whatever, are going to keep them from playing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and be sitting there beating each other and using weapons against each other, not knowing that those weapons do real harm. And it's interesting that you have that visual stimulus at that demographic with all of these animated characters doing martial arts and real-life characters doing martial arts, these that are supposedly, you know, rated for children. At the same time, you know, their diet is all this processed food with a lot of chemicals, especially a lot of high-fructose corn syrup with genetically modified corn. The vaccine damage, etc. And to me, this was one of those other facets that fueled the Jewish war against children, non-Jewish children, of attention deficit disorder. Because one of the big things they always say was, you know, the children, you know, were unruly. They were, you know, couldn't be contained, so therefore they have to be medicated. So in other words, you know, this idea of using martial arts films and cartoons and toys as a stimulus to make these children act out so that they then fit this diagnosis that these Jewish doctors came up with to say there's something wrong with these children and therefore they have to be medicated to keep them calm so that they can participate in classroom activities without sitting there beating up on each other all the time. So, you know, that's just kind of an overview of how this martial arts, Eastern philosophy culture really rose up in popularity in the United States with icons like Bruce Lee and David Carradine, and how Hollywood used that as yet another psychological warfare tool to demoralize traditional Western civilization values, especially, you know, American culture in the post-Civil War Western expansion. Like I said, you'll never see a Jew being put in a bad light in any of the Kung Fu episodes, but almost every episode they made a point to always show, you know, Christians not living up to their book of rules, just like in the Saul Alinsky's, make your enemy live up to their rule book. And so I just think that yeah, this was a huge weapon against us in the 70s, that, you know, the Kung Fu to me was very demoralizing. You know, just that sense of, you know, white people, why do white people behave so bad? Why do they treat this poor squandering stranger so poorly? And so that was, you know, what I was thinking as a lad, and you know, I see it much differently now with these eyes. But as a child, you know, it very much emotionally affected me. Like I said, I was a big fan. I watched every week. I even have several of the first series on videotape here, I believe, that managed to survive the flood. But, you know, that's, again, you know, that idea of serving up these treats for us that always have that drop of poison in them, you know. So it's this great series, but at the same time, you're being poisoned from it. So with that said, like, oh, I'd like to thank the folks that requested that for a topic. Really appreciate that. That was, tonight's show was a request, so always send me, you know, any ideas you have for a show or things you're curious about, and I'll be glad to try to whip something up. So thanks again for the idea for the show, and I hope everyone has a wonderful week, and until next time, I will see you all at the rendezvous.
Do you begin to smell some funky little things going on? Let me share this story with you. It's not so much a story, it's something I wrote years ago. Read your history, people. Stock markets collapse on Friday. Bank seizures, closures, holidays take place after business hours on Friday. Do currencies or governments also collapse on Friday? Tomorrow's Friday. Will the end come on this Friday, or will the inevitable collapse hold off for a while? The next round of the worst financial crisis in 100 years is coming, people, and the government is out to make you and I pay for it. And will your savings survive a global banking wipeout? What happens when the U.S. sees hyperinflation? What if taxes soar not only for the rich? Can you survive the stock market tanks? Well, between a stock market wipeout, waves of bank failures, soaring government spending that will lead to hyperinflation and the destruction of the dollar's value, isn't it time that you prepare for the uncertainty which lies ahead? Protect your money now or forever kiss it goodbye. My friends, I offer you over 6 decades experience of hard asset ownership and knowledge, and I'm prepared to handle the smallest detail in the balanced protection of your portfolio. For as the future of uncertainty continues to blanket this nation of ours, I believe that I can offer you the privacy, safety, security, and possibly some profitability which you deserve. And so I invite you to visit SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com for further information regarding protecting your wealth. Or call me, Jeffrey Bennett, at 602-799-8214. Or by email at KettleMoraineLTD@Cox.net for private consultation. Once again, our phone number, 602-799-8214. It's almost Friday.